indeed a lot to discuss. Last time I was here, in the beginning of December, we talked about medical assistance in dieting, and then it was requested that we extend that discussion to discuss the DNR. I drew my line when Marjorie asked me if for our next session we could discuss grief. I said, I can't do that. I can't take it. And Herman Pesach are coming. You don't want. So we're going to figure out something else for next time. But this is a very serious topic, obviously. And in one sense, I suppose I'm honored to be asked to weigh in. In another sense, I'd be happier if other people were asked to weigh in. It is a hard topic, and you don't need me to tell you. We all are quite familiar with situations in which the question of the DNR comes up. There are more sheets, yes. When the question of the DNR comes up, we know of the cases in which somebody is unable to speak for themselves, and then their relatives struggle with what should be done for them, what shouldn't be done for them. The struggle of, what would my mother, father, sibling, spouse, what they would have wanted, what they would have said, and it's a really hard issue, and I'm not going to be telling you, for the most part, this is what to do, this is what not to do, because it's not the way this works. There really are multiple legitimate perspectives on many of the issues that we're going to talk about, and that's what I want to lay out. And I really believe that one should have a rabbi with whom one discusses this, like the rabbi who knows you, knows your family, knows the community, who can really be responsible to the community to address it. I will also note, I think you all know it anyway, but I want to stress it, my perspective is an Orthodox perspective. That's my training, that's my belief, that's my practice. And so what I say may vary from what you hear elsewhere. The first dramatic case I ever dealt with a DNR type of situation was when I was in synagogue rabbinate, and there was a Holocaust survivor, 89 years old, this was in the U.S., who was on a ventilator. She was very weak. She was in pain, but it was manageable pain. And they reached the stage where they had to decide whether to move from the ventilator to a trach. Because ventilator is only good for 10 days, 2 weeks, depends on which doctor you ask, what the hospital's policy is. And the doctor said, look, she's 89 years old, it's not really going to extend her life, she doesn't have great quality of life, and they were really pressuring the family to just say, enough, we can't do any more, and stop there. And it was really difficult, and the questions only become more difficult from there, right? What if there is pain that we cannot manage? What if there is dementia and they're not aware of what's going on? What if it's not a trach? What if it's a feeding tube? What if the doctor said that the feeding tube doesn't really provide useful nutrition for the body anyway? What if we're talking about IV fluid? What if the doctor says that by giving fluids you could lead to dangerous swelling? There are all sorts of medical complications. There are all sorts of family complications. These become really difficult. In that particular case, the doctor really pressured the family hard to stop everything. The family stood their ground, and she went on the trach. And then she ended up coming out of it and survived another 6 or 7 months, saw the birth of her grandchild. You never know. You really never know. And that's what makes these cases so hard. So what I want to do is to frame a little bit more the challenge that we face when dealing with the DNR situation, what exactly the tensions are from a Jewish perspective on each side of the issue, before taking you through 4 different contemporary approaches to the DNR. It sounds like a lot, and well, it is. But hopefully it'll be clear and even done within the hour. On one side, we have within Judaism a definite sense that even brief life is valuable. Whether it's because it's valuable for the person, whether because it's valuable for their family, whether because it's valuable for the community, brief wife is always considered to be important within Judaism. And it's a very old point, and it's really subject to a debate, interestingly, sort of, you know, that goes within Judaism and beyond Judaism. And it goes back to the question of whether the value of life is inherent and automatic, or whether it depends on the way life is lived. How do I view the value of the human life? There are those who argue that life's value depends on the experience of the person who is living it. If you're happy, if you feel good, if you feel like you're accomplishing, if you feel satisfied, then it has value. But more than 3,000 years of Jewish tradition has argued that there is an objective and consistent meaning, a specific and inalienable purpose to each human life. And it doesn't matter what we see in it, there is a value to it, and the prophets gave their instructions for how one should live one's life with the assumption that all lives can be meaningful. If you take a look on your sheet, source number two. Source number one is just a general point about the value of human life and the fact that we say that we would violate Shabbat, we would violate Yom Kippur in order to save a person's life. But take a look at source number two. Lord Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz. It's really unfortunate it's unfortunate that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks was such a fantastic chief rabbi for the United Kingdom. Because the result of it is that people have forgotten his predecessor. Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz, or Lord Rabbi, I apologize if I get the titles out of order, was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom before Rabbi Sacks, and he was fantastic. And in particular, he was a pioneer in the realm of Jewish medical ethics. He really laid the groundwork for a lot of what has happened in the last 40 years or so in terms of the development of literature on Jewish medical ethics. Take a look at what he says here in number two. He says, the value of human life is infinite, and therefore cannot be divided. Each portion of it is infinite. This is a mathematical point, right? You can't divide infinity by anything. It doesn't work. It then emerges that 70 years of life have the exact same value as 30 years, or 1 year, or 1 hour, or 1 second. This demanding definition of the sanctity of human life is founded not only on strict mathematics or logic. It is founded equally upon ethical considerations. If human life were to be diminished in value because its end was near, human life would lose entirely its absolute value and receive relative value. Relative to its life expectancy, health, benefits to society, right? And once we're willing to say that there is such a thing as a unit of life that is not significant, then we're only debating where you draw the line. Right now we're just negotiating. Now it's only a question of is it an hour, is it a day, is it a week? You know, in the same way that when people say, well, if a person has dementia, then their quality of life is no longer the same. So what about somebody who has mild dementia, right? What about somebody who is developmentally disabled, right? Where do you start drawing the line? It's not a trivial question, and it's triggered the moment you're willing to assign relative value to life. So the debate about whether a person is allowed to declare that her quality of life is not worth living hinges on the question of whether the value of life is, in fact, subject to my personal experience, or whether it's simply absolute. It's not only about death, right? One of the unfortunate things about this topic is that it's always about death, right? But it's not. It's about life and how you live it. You see, if the meaning of life is subject to my definition and my evaluation of its worth, if my life's quality is subject to my evaluation, then I can choose my own meaning for life. I can decide to be a gambler. I can decide to be a physician. Right? I could decide to be Mother Teresa. I could decide to be Donald Trump. It's not for anyone to tell me who I should be. Right? I determine the quality of my life. I determine the value of my life and the meaning of my life. And mercy on the rest of the world. But if the meaning of my life is objectively defined by my tradition, then I have a set of standards and goals that I'm supposed to live up to. It's not for me. There's a limit on my autonomy, effectively. But yes, it goes back not just to the way I live my life, but also the way a person dies. Because a view that said that each person determines the value of her own life will certainly allow people to decide when they cannot bear living any longer. And a view which declares the axiomatic value of each human life will never be open to its extinction. You end up with two polar opposites. And Jewish tradition historically has indeed strongly prohibited murdering a human being, injuring a human being, has placed saving lives atop its pyramid of values, so that almost all laws, as you saw in source number one, are suspended for the sake of human life. Judaism's death penalty applies specifically to those who endanger the physical or spiritual life of others. Overall, Jewish tradition expects us to see objective value in and to protect human life. Now, if I stop there, right, if we had a 10-minute discussion and that was it, then the answer to all of our questions about DNR would seem to be fairly straightforward. But nothing is straightforward in Judaism, and certainly not an issue like this, because there's always competing value. And the competing value here starts with the responsibility to mitigate pain, and certainly not to do anything that will worsen pain, that will extend a person's pain, intensify their pain. And we talked about this, I think, a little bit when we talked about medical assistance and diet. But to refresh your memory regarding some sources, I brought you source number three, a passage from the Talmud, without going through the whole story again, a story from the book of Daniel, the book of Daniel, the third chapter, in which Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, these three Jews who are members of the court of King Nebuchadnezzar, refused to bow down to a statue, even though they know that they'll be thrown into a fiery furnace. And of course, the story is a happy ending for them. They survive the furnace. They don't know that's going to happen in the beginning. But they refuse to bow, knowing it means their death. Observes the Talmud, had they been lashed instead, had they been whipped instead, they would have bowed. Because torture can be worse than death. Pain can be worse than death. And so we have a legal principle, which I brought in source number four from Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, a leading authority in Jewish medical ethics at the end of the 20th century, who says that when the Torah talks about doctors healing people, the imperative for doctors is not only to heal, but also to mitigate pain. That's part of the physician's obligation. So much so that in the case he's discussing, I pulled that line out of our sponsor. He's talking about a case you may be familiar with. We want to alleviate people's pain, mitigate their pain in an end-of-life situation. Very often, the simplest way to do it is morphine, right? Some other opiate. What does morphine do to breathing?
Slows it,
depresses the person's breathing. What if I want to give an increased dose of morphine, but I know that that might lead to the patient's breathing eventually halting? Am I allowed to or not allowed to? We have a no, not allowed to.
Yes,
you are allowed to. Now we have a debate. So, within standard Jewish tradition, the answer is that as long as you don't know that this particular dose is going to halt their breathing, it's not an inevitability. If your goal is to alleviate pain, and it's reasonable to do this to alleviate pain, then you go ahead and you can give the morphine. Now, I've actually heard from palliative care physicians who say that if it's titrated properly, it's not going to cause the person's death anyway. That's their statement. But in general, that's where Waldenberg's point, is that the imperative to mitigate people's pain is so great that we're willing to run this risk in giving the dose. That's the message that we see here. That's number one. So number one on the other side, so to speak. On one side, you have the great value of human life, which is not subject to my personal outlook or experience. On the other hand, we have an imperative of mitigating pain and certainly not causing pain. Add another item to that part of the scale. Everyone within Judaism agrees that there is a point at which we stop, where we say, stop trying to extend a person's life. Enough. Classic story in source number 5, which I think I mentioned last time as well, involves Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the leader of the Jews at the end of the second century, beginning of the third century in Israel. He was the political leader. He used to negotiate with the Romans on behalf of the Jews. He was their scholarly leader. He was the canonizer of the Mishnah, the first text of Jewish law. He's the one who set it down. So he was in great pain in what turned out to be his dying illness. His students are all praying in the study hall for his survival. He is in agony. The maid sees what's going on. At first, she prays for his survival as well. But then she sees, as outlined in source number 5, the pain and discomfort that he's in. And she says, you know what, I want God to win. And she prays that the heavens should overpower the prayers that are coming from this world. She takes a pitcher of water, throws it from the roof, smashes on the ground, distracting everyone below. They were praying, and suddenly they halt, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi dies. Now, that story requires a lot of discussion and explanation. Because if it was the right thing to do for him, why didn't God just have him die, and that's it? And the story is a very interesting one. But what emerges for our purposes is that she is praised for her actions. She is considered to be right for effectively praying for his death. Which leads commentators to note, take a look at source number 6 from the 14th century, Rabbi Nissim, also known as the Ran. He says, sometimes one needs to pray for mercy for the patient to die, such as where the patient is in great pain due to his illness and he cannot live. Now, there's all sorts of rabbinic discussion on this issue. Like, is a caregiver allowed to do that? Meaning, the caregiver is responsible to try to extend their life and try to take care of them. Does it create a conflict of interest if they're simultaneously praying for this person's death? Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who passed away several years ago, but was a major authority in Jewish law in general, and particularly in medical ethics in Israel, take a look at what he said in source number 7. It's an interesting irony he points out. As one requests and prays to God for the patient to die, he is also obligated to involve himself in saving the patient, desecrating Shabbat for him, even many times. If the patient has a medical need on Shabbat, you're going to violate Shabbat in order to save them, even as you're praying to God that they should pass away. Which is why it's very often just best to say, God knows what's best for them. And leave it at that. But you're seeing here a recognition that sometimes it's enough. One more example of that, the last source on the first slide, source number 8, passage from the Talmud. I love the doctors of the Talmudic times. They were so much better than the doctors we have today. Not only could you get an appointment, and not only did they make house calls, but they gave the best medical advice. Look at this. Shmuel said, if someone is struck with Persian lances, and those lances were poison-tipped, he will not live. At this point, give him rich meat, barbecued on coals, and undiluted wine. That's the way to do it. People are good. They restore the desire to live. And perhaps he will live a bit and instruct his household. The key, what I wanted you to note there, is the motivation given for extending this person's life is not all life is meaningful and therefore we have to keep them living longer, so give them burgers and wine forever. What he's saying is, there's a practical reason for this person to live. So that they can instruct the disposition of their assets, that they can give their last messages to their family members. That's where the value is. It's not simply an open-ended, we want people to live as long as possible. So the question is, now with a stronger understanding of what we're looking at, what the imperatives are, we have on the one hand, a strong tradition of absolute value for human life, no matter the unit. And on the other hand, we transcending, causing, in any way allowing, really, pain. And adding to that, we have the recognition that there is a stop. There is a point where you say, enough. Well, if there is an end, all right, it's shorter, right? And so the question becomes, how do you balance these out? Now, the title for this morning, as you see on the sheets, is the DNR in Jewish law. DNR stands for Do Not Resuscitate. I am personally not a fan of DNR documents, even though I am well aware that many people, most people perhaps even, have them. I am aware that doctors are very much in favor of them. Hospitals, nursing homes, and the like will require them. Lawyers, when they're doing a will for somebody, will say, let's do a DNR or let's do some other similar document at the same time. And I understand why. It's much simpler to have a piece of paper that is in a file that has legal weight that says, this is what to do, this is what not to do. My problem with it is that the documents are clumsy. Even the best documents are clumsy, in the sense that situations are always nuanced. And a document once written needs to be updated to reflect new circumstances. People will write something that reflects where they are one day, and then 5 years later, we'll be sitting there with the same document. Their life is different. Their family is different. Their medical situation is different. Why are they being governed and potentially having their life ended based on something they wrote 5 years ago? So when I say that they're clumsy, part of it is the issue of updating, but part of it is the issue of their scope. Meaning, you have something that says, do not carry out CPR. I can give you two very different circumstances in which CPR might be up for question. In one case, you'll say, yes, for sure, do it. And in one case, you'll say, absolutely not. Right? I can give you a case in which the patient is doing fine. They're doing well. They're living, they're functioning, they're meeting their friends and everything else. And then suddenly they have an acute heart incident with no indication that that should lead to any further debilitation whatsoever. Just something just happened. And now the question is, we're on the scene. What do we do? Do we do CPR or not? As opposed to the case in which they're in the hospital with multiple organ failure and a whole host of issues and problems, not to mention great pain, and all CPR will do is break their ribs and then lead to a further problem the next day. There are different circumstances, but my paper just says don't do it. It doesn't say anything about whether it's an acute case, under chronic issues or not. That's my problem. I sympathize with desire for clarity. And especially because there isn't always an opportunity to contact somebody who knows what they wanted and can give real answers. At the same time, that's my problem. So what I usually tell people is I recommend power of attorney, in which you identify people who will be available, and you have backups and so on, who know exactly, to the extent possible, what it is you want, and you have frank conversations with them about what it is that you want. I understand that it could be that no one here is going to listen to that point that I'm saying, but I have to at least get it off my chest. I think it's a really important issue. Yeah?
So, in your opinion, please correct me if I'm wrong, you prefer the power of attorney to a living will.
So,
where a person designates a hospital expression such as no heroic measures, what they tell you in the hospital is, we don't let people die. But no, I am personally acquainted with such a situation. So, Rabbi, what I'm asking is for you kindly to explain to me the difference between the power of attorney and the living will, where the living will says, I don't want pipes and fuses and all kinds of machines to keep me alive. with the doctor's discretion and my family's discretion, I want you to let me go.
Okay, so the question is, what's the difference between the living will, and I'm going to throw in the DNR, and the power of attorney? You mentioned a phrase there, heroic measures. I'm going to come back to heroic measures as well as artificial measures. That's something we have to talk about. But in terms of the overall issue, the term living will is usually used in the context of DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate document. That's the document I'm not comfortable with. The power of attorney, where you say, so-and-so is informed by my wishes, ask them, that's what I'm personally in favor of. But again, I want to state very clearly, you need a rabbi who knows you, who knows Judaism, and who can give you responsible advice based on who you are. I mean, you know, it's irresponsible to, you know, hear someone who comes here once a month or once every 6 weeks and say, okay, this is, you know, this is now what I'm going to do. I don't want that. I'm not promoting that. I'm giving you my personal opinion, but that's all it is. You know, I think it has to be investigated further for each person. So, with that in mind, I want to go through four different approaches to this issue. And they are from one extreme to the other in terms of their stances. I'm going to start with the view that is most on the side of absolute value to life and work my way towards a view on the other extreme, which says, no, there's an end and a person is able to say enough. All four of these views come from competent, responsible authorities in Jewish law, who, all of whom have greater knowledge than I have and likely ever will. All of them come from very respected figures, and if someone said to me, this is my authority who I rely on, for any of them, it would really be unimpeachable. It would be beyond question. So, the first view is a view that says, indeed, all life must be preserved and you can never stop. And the logic goes back to a biblical verse. In Hebrew, "Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha," do not stand by while someone's blood is shed. You have the means of extending their life. You have to do so. An example of this is the classic story of Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion in source number 9. I'll say it outside of the text. This is a period in Jewish history when the Romans, first century common era, when the Romans had decided that the way to break the back of Jewish revolt was to cut off the teaching of Torah. And they said, if anybody teaches Torah in public, we will execute them, we will execute their students. And remember that Torah at this point is being transmitted verbally. So if you cut off the teaching, no one's going to have it. There isn't a text written down. You can just study privately at home. You just have Tanakh, the scripture. But all the discussions and all the laws and everything else, that's all transmitted verbally. Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion said, I don't care what the Romans say. And he sits down in the public square with a Torah scroll and teaches his students. Along comes another sage and says to him, you know they're going to kill you, right? And he says, I know. And sure enough, Romans catch him. They wrap him in the scroll from which he had been teaching. And they set it on fire. And then they put wet sponges between his body and the scroll in order to slow down the process of dying. And his students say to him, if you open your mouth and let the smoke enter, you'll die faster, right? Smoke inhalation. And his response to them is, God takes my life. I don't take my life. He will not allow himself to do anything that will hasten his own death. And the logic behind it is straightforward. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Yehiel Michal Epstein, writing in a work of Jewish law called Arot HaShulchan, said, regarding treating someone who is in great pain, he said, although we see that he, the patient, is in great pain and his death grows, and it will be better for him to die, still we are prohibited from doing anything to hasten his death. The world and all in it belong to God, and such is God's will. So according to this view, we will not do anything. He's talking about there doing anything to hasten death. But within this view, one also doesn't stop doing what one was doing to extend life. So if you take a look at source number 11, and this goes back to the heroic measures question, Rabbi J. David Blight is a leading authority today in Jewish law, medical ethics, but many, many areas. A truly brilliant man, was on the Presidential Council for Bioethics in the U.S. for many years. Take a look at number 11 and what he has to say about the distinction that people make between natural means and artificial means. He says, any distinction between natural and artificial means of treatment is without precedent in Jewish law. Indeed, upon examination, the distinction is fundamentally specious. Right? It's foolish, he says. Medical substances synthesized in the laboratory are certainly not natural, yet it is unlikely that ethicists would regard such medications as artificial. For that matter, even drugs extracted from plants and the like are hardly natural sources of nutrition for man, but assuredly would not be classified as artificial. The obligation to revive a person from drowning, right, is one of the paradigms of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life, and the Talmud talks about how I have to intervene to save someone. So if I see them drowning, I have to help them. That's artificial. That obligation includes the duty to throw a life preserver to the potential victim. In what sense, he asks, is a respirator designed to deliver oxygen to the lungs different from the casting of a life preserver? He says, it's all artificial means. Where do you draw your line? One person's heroic measures or another person's regular routine? This is what we do. Yeah?
Well, one of the patients that requires a life preserver is really not deathly ill. And if you give him the life, he certainly may survive. But the other one, with the stuff from the labs and the plants, that is a very deathly person who's at the door of death. And they're giving him medication, just trying, knowing it's not going to work.
So the question is asked, you have the person who's getting the life preserver. Once they get the life preserver, they're going to be fine. They're going to go on to live 100 more years. You have the other person who you're giving these medications from the plants, who is struggling along and barely making it, and so maybe it'll add another 6 hours to their life for another 12 hours, and then he'll have another thing that needs to be treated. But my question to you, of course, is going to be, so where's your line? Once you're willing to say that, where is the line? What if they can survive 3 days? What if they can survive 6 days, and one of those days is the bar mitzvah of their grandson? Like, you know, how do you draw that line is really hard. So the position that Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Rabbi J. David Blythe, and others take is to say, we should be emphasizing mitigating pain. Take care of their pain, and have them live longer. Source number 12, an interesting quote from the Washington State Medical Association, Pain Management and Care of the Terminal Patient, claimed, 1992, adequate interventions exist to control pain in 90 to 99% of patients. Now, the truth is that's not a comforting number, because 99% of patients means there's still millions of people whose pain you can't control, right? Once you start dealing in real populations, 99% is impressive. So that's one thing that has to be kept in mind. But take a look at Dean Sossin from Osgood, from the Osgood Law School. He wrote this article about the Carter decision from the Supreme Court in which assisted suicide became legal. He says, palliative and hospice care remains one of the more poorly funded and least understood spheres of medicine. The health professions and funding models are understandably directed at healing people. He's right. We're not spending enough on mitigating pain. And Rabbi Blight makes that point in number 14. I'm not going to read it out in the interest of time, but you can take a look at it later. But he says, the key sentence is the one right in the middle of 14. There is no halakhic objection to the use of heroin in the control of pain in terminal patients. Yeah, there are all sorts of rules and laws about which opiates you can use. If you really believe this person is dying in 3 months, in 3 weeks, why are you concerned about heroin addiction? You know, what's the problem here? So that's an important point that he makes, that we're not pulling out all the stops to preserve their life. Instead, what we're doing is we're saying, you know, we can't do anything for them. Let's just stop treating. So So this is school number one. School number one, Rabbi Blank, Rabbi Waldenberg, says, do everything. And in terms of the concern for pain, treat the pain. That's their argument. That's number one. Then number two, the second view is short-term life, which we need to define, obviously. But short-term life need not be extended if you can't mitigate the person's suffering. And suffering is a very broad word. It's not just physical pain. Within this view, we say, chaye sha'ah, to use the Hebrew term, short-term life is not really of the same value as ongoing normal life, even though it's so hard to draw a line between the two. The source number 15 is an example of this, and a good source for it. Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz, in a commentary to the Mishnah, he's talking about the case of a person who was underneath a ruin, the building collapsed on them, and it's Shabbat, and you know that even if you dig them out, they're not going to survive more than a few hours. So he says, to me, digging through a pile of stones is different. For when one removes the stones from him, one certainly eases his suffering. Even though he continues to live in pain, better that he should die slowly and with less pain than for his life to be shortened for him to die painfully beneath the burden of stones. What he's pointing out is an opposition between the story of Rebbe, which we read about, in which it was better for him to die, and the case of the person under the ruin, where you're saying break Shabbat in order to dig him out, even though you can't save him anyway. So the difference is that when it comes to digging someone out of the ruin, you will mitigate their pain by doing so. And that's why we seek to extend their short-term life, because you're also going to take care of their pain. Whereas, he says, but the story of Rebbe with the maid was the opposite. Had she not prayed for his death, his suffering would have grown. So in other words, short-term life is not the same as long-term or normal lifespan. That's the argument that is made. On that basis, take a look at number 16, a very important letter by Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, one of the leading authorities in Jewish law of the 20th century. He says, regarding the basic principle that one must do everything possible to extend the life of a patient, even though it's only temporary life, in truth, he says, I also heard statements like this in my youth, but I don't know whether it comes from someone reliable. In my eyes, this requires great examination. He quotes you a passage from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, which indicates it is clear that one may remove an obstacle to the death of a patient when that would also prevent great suffering. One only may not act upon his body. You just can't do anything to hasten death. But if something is preventing the person from dying, and you'll see what he's talking about in source number 21 below, there's a belief, going back to the Code of Jewish Law and earlier, that a person is dying, and they hear some kind of a noise that attracts their attention, it may keep their focus, and they may live longer. And what the Code of Jewish Law writes is that if there's a wood chopper chopping wood outside the window, and that is keeping somebody going who's in pain, you can tell them to stop, even though you believe that that's prolonging this person's life. So he writes here, you're allowed to do that. You're just not allowed to do anything to his body to hasten his death. And so he writes, if so, then I see no reason to prohibit sitting without acting, where acting would increase suffering. Just the opposite. What you learn from here to refrain from acting. He says there comes a point where you say, I'm not going to continue. To say that's it. And the litmus test is, am I able to mitigate the person's pain? Number one. And if I can't, then I have to say, then what am I doing? And number two, all they would live is a short period of time anyway. Take a look at number 17. Rabbi Eliezer Zilberstein is an authority in Israel today, and he writes, based on what has been said, it appears that a patient may refuse surgery or any therapeutic treatment which involves great suffering. There is no obligation to pain him and cause him suffering with treatment that will extend temporary life. Now, what we haven't done is explain what temporary life means. So there are different views, surprise. One view says 1 year. They can't live more than a year. Rabbi Asher Weiss, who's a rabbi in Israel today, who deals with these issues all the time because he is the rabbi of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel. So Rabbi Asher Weiss says that temporary life means that the person is on a trajectory of death from the current illness. This illness that they're experiencing right now is going to take their life, and whatever I'm going to do is not going to change that. It will simply mean they will survive the illness a little longer in pain that I'm not able to mitigate. That's the definition. And that's your second view. Yeah?
So far, we've only discussed physical cancer. What about psychological pain, or is that not part of this? Because if someone, let's say, tries to commit suicide and they're unsuccessful, they pretty much told you what they want.
Correct. So I was going to get to this at the end, but I'll throw it in now because you raised it, so it's worth mentioning. I was going to discuss that as well as dementia. So Rabbi Zilberstein, who I just quoted in number 17, only discusses physical pain. That's all he takes on. He discusses a case of somebody who's unconscious because of dementia, and he believes that you continue treating. He does not believe that that's the same as pain. However, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who I mentioned earlier, does count emotional pain in his calculus, as does Rabbi Herschel Schachter, who we're going to get to in the fourth view. Also counts emotional pain. It counts the issue of somebody who lived a certain way and now would be distraught over the way their life is at this stage. So the answer is there's a range of views on this point. But your second view says, don't extend a short-term life of pain. I'm not going to write it on the board because I realize I'm going to be out of room anyway. But that's your second view. Third view was from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein may be considered the greatest legal authority in Jewish law in the 20th century in North America, if not the world. He passed away in 1986. And his position was, you don't extend a person's suffering, you don't extend a person's suffering, whether it's short-term or long-term. Even if the person could live years longer by you treating them, if fundamentally you're not going to mitigate the pain, there's no purpose to extending. And he quotes various Talmudic passages, which we've already noted, about the gravity of pain and trying to avoid pain. He quotes Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who I already mentioned before, but he's the one in number 21 as well. Oh, you know what? I didn't mention here. I should have. I'm not sure how I missed mentioning it. Sorry, before I go to Rabbi Feinstein. Oh, I see what I did. It's okay. The source sheet is wrong. What I'm doing now is right. I put things in the wrong place on the source sheet. That's all. I see what I did here. It'll work. He quotes what you have here in number 21. Number 21 should be number 18. That's all. This is the quote from the Code of Jewish Law about extending a person's life, where it says, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, right, in the Ashkenazi part of the Code of Jewish Law, says, what may not cause a dying person to die quickly, however, where something prevents the soul from departing, such as where there is a sound of knocking near the house, such as from a woodchopper, or there is salt on his tongue, and these keep the soul from departing, one may remove them. There's no deed in this, you're not killing the person, he's only removing an obstruction. And Rabbi Feinstein bases himself on that position and says, we don't prolong a life of suffering. We don't end it, but we don't prolong it either. Now go back to number 18, please, where he writes, in such people, where the doctors recognize that he cannot be healed and live, and that he will not live as a sick person without pain, but they can give medicine which will extend his life as he is with suffering. One should not give medicine. Leave them as they are. Classic example, somebody who is dealing with a very painful condition that they're managing, it's chronic, I don't want to start giving specific medical cases. It's a bad idea. But they develop a secondary infection, which the doctors know they could give an antibiotic for, and then they'll go back to being as they were. Or they can say, so that'll be what ends the person's life. And our big Feinstein's position is, where they're suffering and you can't mitigate the suffering, the pain management isn't available, then it's time to say, let it go. Now, Rabbi Feinstein's position is not absolute. When it comes to food, and when it comes to oxygen, he says those have to be given no matter what. If you take a look at source number 19, he says, one must give oxygen, even in a situation in which one cannot heal him, for this eases his suffering. It's part of mitigating pain. The suffering that results from inability to breathe is great, and oxygen removes it. Along similar lines, His Honor, the person who asked the letter, who wrote him a letter about this, asked whether one must feed patients intravenously when they cannot eat and they are in danger. This would extend his life as it is, in suffering, and we think he is not suffering due to not eating. That's what the questioner said. Lack of food is not causing him additional pain. Rabbi Feinstein, writing this, keep in mind, decades ago, he passed away in 1986, this letter is probably from the 1970s, does not believe the person writing the letter. He says, it is obvious that one must feed him food that will not harm and not damage, for this certainly strengthens him a bit, even where the patient himself doesn't sense it, and those who stand and serve him do not sense it. He says, you can't deprive somebody from food. We're Jews. You have to give people food. They say they don't want it. They want it. They say they don't like it. They like it. The position that Rabbi Feinstein takes is you always have to give food. You always have to give oxygen. Similarly, source number 20, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who I quoted earlier, logically, where an ill person suffers from great pain and suffering or even very strong emotional pain, there's that line. He says, I would think that we would be obligated to give him food and oxygen for breathing, even against his will. But we could refrain from treating with medicine that would cause great suffering for the patient, if the patient wished it. The patient has the ability to say no to medicine, but not to food and oxygen, he said. Yes.
Okay, you're talking about food. Are you talking about food, but what about the IV?
Right, so that always raises the question of artificial measures. Right? Is there a difference between spoon feeding somebody something and putting in a feeding tube? Is there a difference between an oxygen tube in their nose and a ventilator and a trach? Yeah?
What about the patient's input and request?
So far.
Nothing to say?
Oh no, look at the line. Look at the last words I had, number 20. If the patient wished it. If the patient wished it, absolutely. In the first view, the view that says do everything, it's not up to the patient. There's no such thing as autonomy on this point. But once you get past that view, the second and third views, the patient has the right to say, enough, I am in pain and you're not able to mitigate it, and on that basis they're able to halt. Or the patient can say, I'm in great pain, but I still want to continue. The patient has the ability to do that. We're going to see this flipped on his head when we get to the fourth view. Just wait. But that's the idea here, is that the patient is able to say, I don't want to continue. But in terms of the question that was asked about, is giving food, are all modes of giving food the same? This is, surprise, subject to debate. It sounds like Rabbi Feinstein and Rabbi Auerbach will agree with Rabbi Blight that there's no such thing as an artificial measure. Giving food by spoon feeding, giving food by feeding tube, they will view as being the same. That seems to be the way that they will take it.
What about if the patient is not able to say so?
So that goes back to the question that we had in the beginning, right, about the DNR and the power of attorney. So Judaism recognizes what's called in law an SDM, substitute decision maker, that somebody else can weigh in on behalf of the patient. And to make a long story short, the way they're supposed to do it is best interests of the patient, not their personal evaluation, but what the patient wanted. Now, I have to say this is problematic in the sense that studies have shown repeatedly that people do a very poor job of guessing what somebody would have wanted. They've done study after study after study on this. And what it points to is the need for people to have frank conversations and be as clear as possible so that whoever's going to be in that terrible position will be able to operate with knowledge. It's really hard to guess what somebody else would have wanted. But Jewish law absolutely empowers them to do so. Yeah.
What if there's a shift? Like, one of my friends, their mother-in-law, they went into the hospital, she had pneumonia, and then the antibiotics wiped out everything, she got C. difficile, and now she's refusing to eat because she's so exhausted, hasn't slept in a month. So at this point, right, she's giving up, right? Her will to live is not there, but her starting point, her baseline, was so different. When she was at her baseline, she was totally with
right, so I'll tell you what. Right, so recognizing that I have 10 minutes to go, I can't do the specific cases, and especially because I'm responsible to be at a class at 11:30. So I need to make sure that I actually lead on time. But one of the things that you raised, Shauna, as part of that question that I think is really important, is recognizing what's behind what somebody says. You know, last time we talked about the definition of death, right? Was last time the definition of death? Not medical assistance and death. Medical assistance and dying was like a couple of sessions ago. I don't know. In any case, you talk about the definition of death. One of the points that are made in the Harvard criteria when they evaluate brain death is they look at hypothermia, they look at the body temperature, and they look at issues of, is the person on medications that might be causing their metabolism to slow down? You have to look at outside forces, and often outside forces that can be removed. When someone says, I don't want to live anymore, you have to ask, why are they saying it? Are they, did they not sleep for the last 2 nights, and they're miserable in the hospital? But if they could get home, that would restore their will to live. You have to look at the whole picture. It's not as simple and straightforward as, they said the magic words, let's stop treating. Okay, so we have three different views articulated at this point. One view is do everything. One view is don't prolong short-term life that is filled with suffering. And one that says don't prolong life that is filled with suffering, even if they can live for years and years that way. And then you have the last view. And this view is always the biggest surprise to people. It was the biggest surprise to me when I learned of it. But this is the view articulated by Rabbi Herschel Schachter, who is a Rebbe of mine at Yeshiva University. In number 22, I just noted Rabbi Feinstein's explicit statement that it doesn't matter whether it's short-term life or long-term life. As far as he's concerned, you don't prolong life of suffering. But in terms of the question of the autonomy to refrain, to say I don't want to be treated, Rabbi Herschel Schachter basically says it's up to people in many situations to make this decision for themselves. There is a high degree of autonomy. And he points out a passage in the Talmud, which I'm going to explain outside of the text of our brother number 23. The Torah says that if somebody works for me, I am obligated to pay them on the same day they do the job. Can't wait. Obviously, if you make a contract with them and they say, pay me after 30 days or pay me at the end of the week, that's a different story. But the default is, you pay the person on the day they do the job. And the text in the Torah, when it speaks of this, says, because this person put his life on the line for your work. And the Talmud expands and says, people endanger themselves when it comes to earning a living. They'll be a construction worker. They'll harvest things from the tops of trees. They put their lives on the line. Which leads to a question. How is it that someone is allowed? If we believe so strongly in the absolute value of life, how is this person allowed to engage in a parnasa, to seek a livelihood, which is going to endanger their lives? Right? You shouldn't be allowed to do that. Why should I be allowed to pursue a line of work which is going to endanger my life? I should find some other line of work, something less dangerous than clergy. So the answer is that there is such a thing as a normal level of risk. Something which people are willing to sustain. I am willing to drive on a highway, even though I know full well that there are Toronto drivers all around me. I'm willing to walk across the street at Bathurst and Finch, right? Again, knowing that there are Toronto drivers all around me. There are risks that are considered to be normal that everyone in society just lives with, right? Getting up out of bed in the morning shifts your blood pressure. There's a risk. But, you know, this is what we live life. There is such a thing as tolerable risk. And argues Rabbi Schachter, this applies here as well. He says there are three different types of cases. He says, in a case in which there are reasonable grounds to say that everybody would want to live, if you were to poll 100 people and say, given this health situation, what would you want? Would you want to be treated? And, you know, the extreme majorities would say, yes, I want to live, then you don't have the right to forfeit your life. Even if you yourself say, I don't want to, doesn't matter. That's one extreme. Then the opposite extreme, and this is where autonomy goes out the window. I said, it flips everything on its head. In a case in which 100 people polled would say, no, that's suffering, we would never want to go through that. If the patient says, I would want to go through it, argues a rich after, the doctors are not allowed to treat. Because you are causing this person harm, you're causing the person pain. The Talmud states, self-harm is prohibited. So even though, you know, someone walks up to me and says, hit me, and they're serious about it, I'm not allowed to hit them. So here, I am not allowed to extend such a person's life. Those are the two polar opposites. Everybody would want, nobody would want. And then all the cases in the middle, where some people would say yes, and some people would say no. Rabbi Schachter's position is, do what you want. That's his position. He said, and I asked him this question as a practical question on behalf of people who were in such situations. And I'm asking, are they obligated to continue? And he says, no. And he includes food, and he includes oxygen. I brought you a quote of him, although I've heard it from him directly, but take a look at source number 25. This appeared in a published article several years back. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, as well as Rabbi Tassel Horowitz and Vienna Rupp, maintain that if artificial nutrition and hydration are medical procedures which a terminal patient may direct to be with health. So you have here four different views from one end of the spectrum to the other in terms of the advice they give, all anchored in Jewish sources. You know what's really interesting to me, and with this I'll get to the end here. Many years ago, when I was a synagogue rabbi, I was at a wedding, and I had a question on one of these end-of-life type issues. And Rabbi Schachter was at the wedding, and I went to him and asked him the question. And he felt it was a complicated medical issue, and so he referred me to somebody else. He referred me to Rabbi Dr. Avram Silver Abraham, who was, for decades, the head of internal medicine, Unit B, at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel, who is a world-class expert in Jewish law when it comes to medical issues, has written incredible works on it, and who is a student of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, whose positions are very different from Rabbi Schachter's positions. But he referred me to Rabbi Dr. Abraham. And at the time, I wasn't sophisticated enough in my understanding to realize what he was doing, that he's referring me to somebody who disagrees with him. But that's what he did. And I asked the question, I got my answer, and that was it. And then years later, when I realized, he sent me to somebody he disagrees with on a life and death issue. Like, how do you do that? And so I went back and I asked him. I said, you know that he disagrees with you. Like, when you say that you should stop, he says you should keep on going. And his answer was, they asked me, in your conversations with Rabbi Dr. Abraham, is he a Yerushalayim? Is he God-fearing? Are his answers based in Torah? And the answer is clearly yes. He said, that's what you need. You're not looking to say, this is my view, this is the right view, and everybody else is off the table. It has to be anchored in, in motivations which are reverent of God, motivations which are not personal, which are not tinged by all sorts of outside considerations, but which are, as we call it in Hebrew, lishma. They're altruistic, they're for the sake of God, they're for the sake of doing right by the patient. And if that's so, and if they come to it from, you know, authentic Jewish tradition, then wherever you end up on this spectrum of four views will indeed be correct. Thank you very much. Yeah.